Hello, and welcome to Anime's Journey to the West. I'm Coley Boyd, pronouns are they, them.
Hey, I'm Zeb Berryman, my pronouns are he and him.
Hi, I'm Lydia Lewis, pronouns are she, her.
Hi, I'm Liz, the Bodacious Barista is back again, and my pronouns are she, her as well.
All right, so everybody has watched at least the requisite amount of episodes. Some of us are like a little bit ahead, and one of us watched this show when they were 18, but has forgotten extremely important plot details, and that one is me. So I think we should just jump into a recap. People can interrupt me during this recap to talk about stuff in it. But anyways, we open on a couple of shots of Neo Verona, where we set our scene, along with narration about how the floating island city has been forgotten and that it was once a good place. Then we see the dramatic backstory as the Capulet's family is threatened by a young Papa Montague.
Threatened?
Lord Capulet
does not do that justice. That was much more than threatened.
They're definitely, certainly going a bit more intense than I was expecting.
Yeah, they do go pretty intense. I was getting to the more murdery parts, though. Lord Capulet says that something called Aeschylus should protect them, but Montague says it doesn't matter.
So,
meanwhile,
I have a theory about that.
What is your theory?
Isn't Aeschylus the name of the prince in the original work?
Oh, it might be.
I thought it was like Arceus, like from Pokemon kind of deal. Like, oh, I guess they don't call God God. They call him Aeschylus.
So I'm just thinking that Aeschylus might be like someone above the Montagues in the like royal lineage or whatever.
Yeah. But anyways, Lord Montague says that Aeschylus doesn't matter. Meanwhile, we see Juliet being taken to see her mother by a slightly older girl named Cordelia. Cordelia sees the family as they're being killed, so she covers Juliet's eyes and runs, but Lord Montague orders the guards to go after them. They're almost cornered, but are saved by an older man named Conrad and escape on an extremely cool dragon Pegasus thing called a dragon steed.
I love them.
Yeah.
I want one.
Yeah.
I know they don't exist, but I want one so bad.
Yeah. We cut to 16 years later when a young woman is about to be executed by her supposed relation to the Capulets, which seems to be just bullshit. It seems to be like a thing where her neighbors accused her because they didn't like her and the guards just took it as fact.
The guards are like, listen, we get to kill somebody? Awesome. I signed up for this.
Can I cut in for a sec?
Sure.
So this girl is about to be like arrested and probably executed for being the last remaining Capulet. And then we get this scene where basically this like masked vigilante, wide brimmed hat, red outfit, leaps
like
in, basically a red Zorro, leaps in, taunts all the guards, frees the girl, and takes off running.
Yeah, it is extremely cool.
Also, just fun fact, Zorro should be red because Zorro is Spanish for fox.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but that was the side, but like, I love it, and it's just, it's very great action. Unfortunately, the very, like, I would say after the murder of the Capulets, the first scene you get is like these like awful CGI flags billowing in the wind. And they come up in the next episode, too, but that's the only bad animation, I would say, in this whole series so far.
The animation is just fantastic and beautiful and very fluid.
Yeah, the animation, as I recall, remains really good throughout, but the CGI is never particularly well integrated.
And some of the CGI, I'm like, I question why, because I'm assuming the flags, they don't have to billow that much, and they're not like a major focus, so I wonder why they chose. It's not a very difficult thing to animate 2D. I'm just curious that they did it to do it.
Yeah. It kind of feels like that. Anyways, so she runs. She's helped by a small child named Antonio, Juliet is called Odin throughout this sequence, and I just want to note that Odin is an extremely funny boy name to give her.
Yeah. Why is that funny?
I just think that it's weird that they gave her the name of a Norse god as her other name.
It is weird, but it's also powerful.
And also probably after her royal heritage, but I wish it was a little more Italian themed, because this is very like what Shakespeare thought of Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we get characters with names like Antonio, Curio, and like Francisco, and then we get Odin. It's a bit strange.
Yeah, we also get William.
We'll get to William. Let's.
Yeah. One thing I do want to note on the animation is that when I saw this was going to be Gonzo, I was like, oh shit, it looked terrible. And so I was massively surprised by how good it looked. Gonzo, known for quality animation.
Gonzo always starts with pretty high quality animation and downgrades as the show goes on, though.
Gonzo, like, when they were good, but when they were bad, oh, they were bad. I kind of miss them sometimes, but then I'm like, you know what? They probably went out the way they should have.
Yeah. We get a pretty fun chase scene where we are reintroduced to Cordelia, who quite clearly just wanted to have a nice, normal day and did not want to be pulled into this superhero nonsense. And meanwhile, we see Romeo and his friend Benvolio talking over breakfast. They notice the Crimson Whirlwind's plight, and Romeo decides to dive in to help. And Benvolio is kind of like, why can't we just have a normal breakfast? So they come across, like, this broken bridge thing. Juliet falls. Romeo swoops in to save her. Romeo's kind of like, bro, you've got such little wrists. Afterwards, Cordelia is quite thankful, but Juliet is still mad because she knows that Romeo still benefits from the circumstances that she interrupted, while Romeo is unaware of his privilege in this situation. So it just looks like this guy he saved is being a huge dick for no reason. They have kind of a bit of an argument and then go their separate ways. In a pretty cute gag, the gag go into the operas where Otello, the opera version of Othello, which is an actual thing in real life, is playing. We see one nobleman who's super into it, but everyone else looks bored. And we meet William, a very camp playwright who despairs that no one likes his plays. Juliet says it's because they're overwritten and they suck, and he gets mad.
This show is surprisingly, mean to the playwright they're adapting.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
He looks awful. Because he doesn't dress like everybody else. He dresses like a stereotypical portrait you've seen of William Shakespeare, but with blonde hair and a horrible goatee that nobody... Listen, goatees don't work. They don't. I'm sorry. Shaggy, if you're hearing this, shave it now. It's not the dog or the weed that's stopping you from getting dates. It's the goatee. I'm sorry.
Hey, don't disparage my boy Saggy like that.
I'm with Liz on this one.
Yeah. he says that she's gotten handsome and she should be in the play. They end up going downstairs, have a brief conversation with Conrad and a few others. During this time, we realize no one has told Juliet that she's the Capulet heir. This seems extremely stupid. I don't know why they went to all the trouble of like, oh yeah, you have to dress like a boy this entire time.
And never told her why.
They never told her why they did this. And all of the problems she gets into in this episode come entirely based on the fact that she doesn't know that she's going into the den of her greatest enemy.
Yeah, and you know, and this is especially stupid having watched ahead, knowing what they intend for her, but that'll be for later.
Yeah, that's for later episodes. Yeah, I don't know why they did this. This seems extremely silly and dumb.
From what I've seen, I think it probably had to do with the characterization of Juliet up to this point.
Yeah.
And events we haven't touched on in the recap, but are coming up.
Yeah. Right. So, like, after this, Cordelia kind of brushes Juliet's hair and it falls to twice its original length.
Much more than twice.
Like,
yeah, I'm not sure how they do this. She doesn't have a ponytail or anything. She has, like, a pixie cut. How do you just, like...
Is it magic?
It's anime logic.
I think it might be... There are some very, like, sparse fantasy elements within the story, like the Pegasus dragons. I'm like, if they went, like, oh, it's an enchantment or something, you just have to brush your hair to, like, have it stop.
It's
fine.
Yeah.
It's just
and
odd.
The reason it's fine is because they describe her, or is because they call her Princess Juliet in the second episode, which we're going to discuss as well. And so it's fine. She's just another princess with magic hair. It's okay. Admittedly, yeah. This magic hair is probably a lot cooler than most magic hair.
But yeah, she can somehow keep it all under a wig.
It's not a wig.
Not a wig.
Okay,
that's
go ahead.
That's her hair. Anyways, we cut to a race using dragon scenes and are giving our first introduction to Lord Montague, aged up. He looks extremely sinister and is greeted by Mercutio? Question mark?
He reminds me of, I want to say, I think Ivan the Terrible?
Yeah, that is a design similarity. So
yeah,
he
just reminds me of, like, Ivan the Terrible for no goddamn reason.
It's probably the beard, honestly. So when he asks where his son is, Mercutio does one of the most over-the-top pantomime performances imaginable to say he doesn't know and to imply Romeo was kind of a moron for not showing up yet. There's like a smirk, there's like a shrug mid-sentence. He does a lot of hand gestures throughout this.
He's Italian, okay? Which, don't mock him for his heritage.
The thing that is funny to me is that Mercutio in this seems very different from the character from the play. So when Romeo does show up, he explains that he was trying to be among the people so that once he inherits the throne, he can better rule them. Montague decides that now is the time to reply with a cool villain speech, where he asks, "What would you do with this knowledge? Without a rider to wield the reins, a dragon steed flies aimlessly. A kingdom is much the same. A noble must rule with an iron will and a liberal whip, or watch his kingdom fall under the weight of lesser men."
Totalitarianism, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So after giving this ideological framing of all his future misdeeds, a pretty young noblewoman named Lady Hermione, who is pretty obviously this show's version of Paris, shows up. Lord Montague pretty unsubtly tries to set her up with Romeo. She's clearly super into it, and he is clearly polite.
Yes.
There is no chemistry whatsoever. As soon as she shows up, he's like, "Hi, yeah."
Yeah, Romeo is polite to her, and he is clearly not into her at all.
To such a degree, it's like, can you at least try talking to her? Or, like, I don't know if he's shy to talk to girls, or he's just like, I feel nothing towards this person.
I mean, I
don't think it's the first one. I think it's that he just doesn't feel anything toward her.
Yeah.
And he knows what his dad is trying to do.
Because his dad is subtle as a schemer, but not as a matchmaker.
Yeah, he basically goes, "Hey, son, here's your new wife."
Elizabeth kind of, I think, mentioned a thing that was, like, kind of a key to this series in a chat I was in earlier, where she said that, she said that the show kind of feels a little bit Fire Emblem-y, and I think that Lord Montague makes a lot of sense if you just imagine him as a Fire Emblem villain.
Like, a lot of the design choices, like, you have these crests of the Montague and the Cap and the Capulets, which have a lot of heavy symbolism. Like, Fire Emblem Three Houses did that. A lot of other Fire Emblem houses, Fire Emblem games did that. Like, the Capulets, they're represented by irises. They're red. Meanwhile, the Montagues are blue and roses, and that carries over in the design choices for Romeo and Juliet. And I feel like there's, like, a lot of flower symbolism that'll pop up. But also, Romeo looks a lot like Crom.
Yeah, he does. And Papa Montague looks like the main villain in every game where, like, an evil old guy is the main villain.
And like, Juliet looks like Cordelia in the other tough chick from Fire Emblem Awakening. I can't remember her name, though. She's like the tough tomboy that's a redhead that has a pixie cut.
Yeah.
I see. I hadn't put that together, but the most recent Fire Emblem game I've played was Sacred Stones on Game Boy Advance. So I'm way behind on Fire Emblem.
So we are introduced to Will's lead actress, Amelia, whose personality I would best describe as almost every theater kid I have ever met.
Sugar baby? Because Amelia's a sugar baby and I fully support it. I'm like, go girl, go get that Shakespearean money, but also please have common sense, just a smidge.
Yeah, William gets mad at her for doing the romancing badly. See, she says it would be easier with Odin.
Who is currently being a sheep.
With Antonio?
Yeah, like there's a really funny part early on where she complains about something and Shakespeare just goes, "What do sheep say?" And she goes, "Bah." It's extremely funny.
I thought that we were going to see like a lot of characters in drag during the play parts, because during Shakespeare you couldn't have women actors. You would only have to have like anyone assigned male at birth in those roles.
I'm glad they didn't go with that though.
I know. Yeah. It probably would have been offensive rather than like interesting or anything. It probably would have been more offensive, or they would have been like, "Oh, Juliet, you like look so well in costume."
One thing that I want to give note to is Brianna Palencia, I believe that's how you pronounce her name. Her performance as Juliet is really good.
She's great in this.
Yeah.
She is definitely like one of the standout actors. So she says it would be easier if it was Odin, but Juliet's not interested. So she tries to do it, saying that would be an opportunity to pretend to fall in love with a beautiful woman. Juliet's still like, "No, girl." So she gets a little bit mad and she's going to leave. Will tells her that she should keep practicing, and she tells him that he should finish his goddamn play, and he is shocked by this. We get this great sequence that starts with Romeo and Benvolio talking. Benvolio comes in and is like, "Oh, you'll be spending the time with the lovely Hermione. Heavy is the heart that wears the crown." And then, like, Romeo's just like, yeah, that's great. And he's just like, "Okay, so clearly this isn't working. Do you have a problem with her?" And Romeo's like, "No, I don't really have a problem with her. It's just..." And then Benvolio smiles and is like, "Oh, it's just that it isn't love."
Can I say something? I think Benvolio has a crush on Romeo.
Oh, he clearly has a crush on Romeo.
100%.
I was just coming to that, honestly. So, meanwhile, Juliet asks Will what it's like to fall in love with somebody. And up till this point, we've mostly seen Shakespeare be kind of, like, ridiculous and, like, a little bit shrill and camp. But this time he just kind of, like, pauses and thinks about it for a minute. And then he tells her, "Well, let me think. Falling in love is finding something you're worth risking your life for. And that's all you get on short notice." Meanwhile, Romeo asks the same question to Benvolio, Benvolio just kind of blushes when Romeo asks him that question. And his answer is somehow even more complete than Shakespeare's, where he's just like, it's finding the one you wish to die with. A passionate connection meant to last a lifetime. And, you know, Romeo's like, have you ever been in love with anyone? And he just gives, like, a complete non-answer. Basically, whether the creators of the show intended it or not, Benvolio clearly has a crush on Romeo.
And it's very interesting for this character who, like, you can assume from William's age that he has had romances before, has experienced love before. But Benvolio is, like, 16, as long as Romeo. And for him to give that kind of answer and to be so sincere about it while he's talking to Romeo, you're like, this is about you. How thick are you, Romeo?
Yeah.
Kiss your twink friend.
Just make out already. It's fine. You can do that.
I mean, Romeo, I think the overall thing that we learn from watching these two episodes is that Romeo is a very nice boy who does not have a brain.
Yeah.
He has all the heart, but no brain. I would say, does Romeo get big himbo energy?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, a little bit. Comes Coley with their definitions about himboism.
Yeah, give Romeo about 50 pounds of muscle and he'll be a himbo.
I'm still saying himbo energy.
So Romeo also gives... I still wanted to call him a himbo because he gives me the energy of where he is dense to how other people feel, but otherwise, by the story, he's just treated as, like, an intelligent guy.
Anyways, so Amelia convinces Odin, Juliet's male alter ego, to dress up as a woman to be her escort.
She's a sugar baby. I love it. She's like, I'm going to marry rich.
Yeah.
I love it. Good for her.
Yeah, she's like, I need a chaperone, but can't be a man, because if it's a man, people will think that I'm here with, like, a boyfriend or a suitor or something. So I've got to be here with a woman, and I don't have any female friends, so you should just dress up as a woman to be my escort.
I would have to say, this show is pretty, like, I get very queer-friendly vibes from this show. It's very, like, no one is like, oh, that's, like, she's not like, it's gonna be weird, but could you please do it? She's just like, no, could you do it? There's no shaming, there's no, like, fear of, like, societal judgment, because there's an implication, like, it doesn't really matter in this universe.
Oh, is Juliet meant to be, like, gender fluid? Because it seemed like sometimes just, like, nah, I'm gonna be a boy and do boy stuff right now. And then other times it's like, I really want to be a girl right now. Look at my nice dress and pretty makeup.
I got those vibes as well. It was very interesting. She's like, I want to express myself and my gender in certain ways, and let me do that.
Yeah. Like, she's like, I want to be, like, a girl for, like, one night. And, like, she has, like, clear feelings of, like, gender euphoria in this sequence. Anyways, so she ends up going into the dress and stuff and gets the long hair. And then Amelia walks off into another room. And then her patron, who is the other most ridiculous man in this entire series, drags Juliet off, apparently thinking that she's Amelia, despite the fact that they don't look that similar. Like,
they look nothing alike.
They look nothing alike. They have different hair. They have, like, different faces. I think their heights are pretty significantly different too.
I think Juliet's taller.
Yeah, Juliet, I think, is taller. So he drags her off. And when they're in the carriage, he's just like, oh, you've changed something about yourself. And I was just like, dude, even if you thought it was the same person, you can't just be like, oh, you've changed something about yourself. Hell yeah, she's changed something about herself. Her hair length is more than twice the size that it usually is, and a different color. Don't try to be coy with this, dude.
And it's the difference between blonde and, like, anime redhead.
Yeah. This is also supposed to be a masquerade, but everybody's masks are like so small that you could easily recognize anyone.
And Juliet doesn't even bother wearing hers throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, but they go to this...
It falls off.
Yeah, they go to this... I'm just going to say, absolutely gorgeous ballroom. Like this ballroom is, like, really pretty.
It really is. That scene was real cool.
And she gets, you know, like, flashbacks to the fact that she's been here before. She goes into the garden and sees a pool of rose petals and reaches down for a single lily. She and Romeo finally see each other and blush as the rose petals fall. And, like, also a very pretty sequence. And then the end theme plays and it rips. That is my entire commentary on that.
The MV is just, oh my god.
It is a pretty fucking baller.
It's a hard rock song, and it fits really thematically well. And I kind of wonder, I'm like, okay, you had this. And the opening is great, but it's You Lift Me Up as a Japanese cover of the song You Lift Me Up, and it still, like, messes with me remembering that.
It's also kind of funny to think about the fact that this show, and admittedly this is more of a shonen trope, and this show, I don't know what I'd genre it, but it's closer to shoujo. It is, like, generally a trope in a lot of anime to have, like, a super hype opening theme and then, like, a more quiet contemplative end theme. And this show just, like, turns it around, which is interesting. So then we get, like, an absolutely gorgeous episode preview courtesy of Will, where instead of just describing the plot, he decides to do some poetry. And he go, and I'm just going to read it outright. Pure heart, two souls intertwine this fair eve, both drawn to the other and beguiled by passions innocent yet so naive. A destiny can young love so defile. And yeah, it's a very pretty way to do an episode preview. I really like it.
It was really cool. Can we take a moment and discuss how the dialogue changes from the first episode to the second?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because that was wild. The first episode, they basically speak like normal people the whole episode. And then the second episode, a couple minutes into the second episode, that changes.
You get some twas. You get some thous. You get some archows.
You get some wake thee up slugabeds.
And it's very interesting. I think if they peppered it in a little more subtly, I think it would have been fine. But it's a very big change. Because in the first episode, they speak formally, but not out of place for modern times. If he's like, you know, it's like you at work when you're talking to your boss versus where art thou?
Yeah, it's interesting. It will, I'm going to say I really like the fact that they do this kind of thing for this dub, but it will never be consistent at any point.
And we need to talk about that.
Lydia, tell us, who wrote it?
Taliesin Jaffe, one of the Critical Role guys. I forgot who he plays on Critical Role.
He plays Percy.
Percy, yes. But yeah, one of the Critical Role guys wrote the script for the English dub of this. And this is the first time I've encountered this man's writing. Why is it so inconsistent? It's good, but it's really inconsistent.
I believe he also wrote the Helsing dub.
He did.
I didn't watch Helsing, so.
Oh, he either directed, but it's been ages.
He either directed or wrote them or both. I'm not sure. Sometimes the inconsistency is similar to what they do in actual Shakespeare plays, where, like, the characters who are, like, not nobles speak in prose. Everybody speaks in prose on the show. I should note that last podcast episode, I said that people talked in iambic pentameter, and that's just not true. The characters talk in the characters talk in a Shakespearean version of English, but they're not talking in iambic pentameter. The closest thing to that is the episode previews.
I was glad to see that they used the wherefore arts correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was very bizarre to hear.
I was so happy that the wherefores are actually correct. Because people think that wherefore means where, but it actually means why. And Juliet uses it correctly in the next episode. Which we can review the two episodes together at the end, I think. Let's go into that episode. So Juliet and Romeo see each other and kind of shyly flirt. He mentions that she smells of lilies.
No, he irises. Gets,
oh, irises, yeah. She gets his name, but before he can get hers, Benvolio interrupts to tell him his father is looking for him, and she runs off. And then we get the theme song, and then we get to the episode. His father coldly greets him, and it is like legitimately funny how little his father cares about putting on appearances with this whole arranged marriage thing. Like he
literally just shows up and he's like, "All right, everyone. My son here is going to marry this lady here. It's cool."
He doesn't
deal.
He doesn't bother to smile while he says this. And then he just kind of like literally just shoves Romeo forward. It is extremely funny.
And Romeo's just like, "Wait, what?"
Yeah. Yeah, because Romeo is probably the most emotionally dense person who has ever lived. Because he apparently did even notice that his dad was trying to set him up with Hermione, despite the fact that his dad was, like, very bluntly trying to set him up with Hermione. Meanwhile, Juliet tries to leave, but two guards are blocking her way and asking if she belongs at the ball to begin with. A tall, handsome dude with long hair interrupts. This is Francisco. I don't think I wrote that down anywhere in this recap. To claim that she's from a minor house associated with House Montague and chose its like royal crest to get them out of the way. Romeo, like, very briefly tries to keep up appearances, but eventually claims to be sick and hands Hermione off to Benvolio.
Hold on, I have to point something out. When this happens, she's like, "Aren't the roses beautiful?" And he's like, "Actually, the smell of roses are making me sick. I need to go now."
I think it's also a reference to the fact that he hates his own family and hates anything to do with them. And he's like,
and roses are associated with the Montagues.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which also shows that Romeo does two things a lot. One of them is that he walks around not noticing very clear emotional signals that people send to his way. And the other thing is that he just goes from room to room making political mistakes.
Yeah, basically.
He looks out at the distance, and we get a shot of the Montague house that belongs on Anime Aesthetics as we switch to the carriage. Conrad is real mad at going for the Rose Ball. Well, Francisco is more sympathetic, but still thinks it was a mistake. Neither of them have told her why she shouldn't go, really, though, because they can't, because they have to, like, not tell her why she should be afraid to go to hide the fact that she's the heir, which is, again, I think is really stupid. So she kind of confronts Conrad about how he won't tell her about her past, and he continues to say he'll tell her after her birthday like a fucking dumbass.
Yeah. That's the dumbest thing.
Conrad, I recall being a kind of smart character in the later episodes, but he comes off like a real dumbass in these episodes.
Just a great dum-dum.
So that morning, Cordelia wakes Julie up and is like way cooler about the party, but regrets that she could never go to a party like that due to her rough hands. So, and then she says that she's going to go do laundry and Conrad's going to be out. So Antonio and Juliet decide to go and fight crime. So in a plotline that seems way too dark for the tone of the rest of this episode, we are introduced to this slimy loan shark who uses loans as an excuse to kidnap girls and sell them into sexual slavery.
Yeah, that was real fucking dark.
Yeah,
for no reason.
Yeah, that seems way darker. I mean, I get that the setting is kind of like a harsher setting than it initially appears, but that is like way darker than this show needed to go at all, especially at this point, because like the rest of the
there was a purpose for it though.
Yeah,
and it wasn't exactly treated like it was all that dark.
Because they talk about how he's planning to sell them to the nobles and how he's like sucking up and trying to get the favor of Lord Montague. And like hearing that really tells you a lot about the setting at this point.
Yeah.
This is apparently why Juliet is the Red Whirlwind.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this is apparently completely legal. So Juliet shows up and yells, "Release these maidens or drown with your inequities in your own blood," because she's incapable of not being extra. There's a pretty fun swashbuckling sequence where she beats all but one of the guy's minions, but then loses her sword, only to be saved by her grim, scar-faced friend, Kirio.
He's like the hottest guy in the anime so far. Is he anime pretty?
Yeah.
Yeah, somehow he's daddy.
Yeah. And she ends up cutting up the contract and sending the noble fleeing away. So due to her injuries, she's taken to a doctor. While he's talking to her, he talks about how robbing from the rich is great and all, but before the Capulets were overthrown, there was some degree to which everyone was taken care of in this society, meaning that in the backstory of this Middle Ages fantasy setting, what is better than where we are in America right now?
Yeah.
I got, like, a weird vibe from that guy. Is he supposed to be, like, Father... what's his name? Friar...
You could interpret him as being similar to Friar Lawrence. There's another character who also is kind of similar in a different way later on. Kirio criticizes Juliet for dealing with symptoms rather than the greater problem. And Juliet, like, pretty justifiably asks what the fuck she's supposed to do as just one person. And he kind of gestures towards her heritage, but, you know, then refuses to answer when she questions him further. And she's, like, pretty justifiably mad. And she's just like, "It's literally my 16th birthday. You can just tell me." And he's like, "No.
You'll find out tonight."
Yeah. So Juliet rejoins the maid group. Conrad tries to lecture her. Well, Francisco suggests that her determination to help people is actually her most heroic trait. This makes Conrad more mad because he's a grumpy old man. In a sweet gesture, Juliet gives Cordelia a poultice for rough hands. Then she runs off to see William, and Conrad's just like, "Wait, I'm not done yelling at you yet." But as she goes, he looks a bit sad and kind of wonders how she's even managed to survive this long, given how reckless she is. And maybe you shouldn't have raised her to be so reckless, dude.
Maybe you should have told her how important she was.
Anyways, Francisco kind of wonders if the city itself is protecting her. And Kirio wonders if she'll ever know peace again after what they're going to reveal to her. William describes the plot of As You Like It, and Antonio thinks that it sounds dumb, which, to be fair, it is. As You Like It is one of Shakespeare's most uninteresting plays, but this is more to highlight Antonio's immaturity. Juliet wonders if love could bloom between people of different blood, because she still doesn't know she's a noble herself. Shakespeare tells her that all the world's a stage in a way that's kind of a misquote of the original one. Like, they used the wherefores correctly, but this quote is kind of wrong because all the world's a stage is actually not supposed to be this positive thing. It's the character talking about his deep depression. But yeah, he tells her that all the world's a stage and nobody can really help who they love.
And then there's that part where she's like, you know what play I like? A Midsummer Night Dream.
Oh, no, that's earlier. She said the ball was like a Midsummer Night's Dream.
Okay.
Yeah. So Romeo walks in the flower garden with Hermione. She talks about his recovery and tries to flirt with him. And he continues to be polite but distant and barely even tries to keep up appearances.
Once more, she's like, don't you like the roses? And he's like, nah.
He is polite, but it's very dismissive. She's trying to make conversation, and he's not really adding to it. And he's kind of killing it. And it's just, I get it. You don't like her. She probably knows that you don't want to marry her. But, you know, your horrible father is probably pushing for it. And maybe you want to make her life seem a little better.
Well, the other thing is that Hermione is clearly extremely into him, and yeah, I feel very bad for her. Like, the poor girl is, like, in an arranged marriage, and she got to be, like, one of the few people who gets to be in an arranged marriage with somebody that she's genuinely attracted to, but then that person, like, just does not care about her at all.
And she's such a sweet girl. She even has the stereotypical, like, shy, nice girl anime voice. And I really like the actress doing the performance. It's just perfect. It's natural. I feel so poor for the girl. She's just so nice.
Yeah. He sees the kind of flower that Juliet picked up and is really excited. And she's just like, what the fuck is going on? Which is the correct thing to think when the person you're in an arranged marriage to suddenly becomes obsessed with flower symbolism. In the next scene, Juliet is in girl mode. Cordelia briefly scolds her. Juliet just kind of sticks her tongue out cutely. She asks where the it wasn't lilies.
They weren't lilies.
Irises?
Yeah, irises. She asks where she could find irises. And kind of mentions that she was told that she smelled like them. And she's so clearly desperate that Cordelia tells her to go, but still chides her not to be late for her birthday party. So we cut to Romeo flying on his dragon steed. He sees Juliet in the place where the flowers bloom. The two of them blush, and he asks her name. He asks why he wants to know, and he says, why, simply because it is yours. The two flirt a bit more, but then they separate due to Juliet's birthday. They agree to meet the next day.
I was really expecting the Rose by Any Other Name speech there, and it didn't come.
Yeah. They agree to meet the next day. Juliet is just overjoyed that she got to meet him twice. So after a nice scene at their birthday where Antonio is shocked by Juliet being a girl and is really just like, but you wore trousers. How trousers but girl? And then they go on a carriage ride to a graveyard. Conrad finally reveals the true truth. Juliet is the true Capulet heir and the entire rest of the family has been killed. He calls her the heir to a slaughtered house. A group of people all arrive and bow before her in preparation of rebellion.
And she looks absolutely terrified
because
during this whole scene.
Yeah, because she's...
The whole scene is actively frightening.
Yeah, because she's not been prepared for this at all.
Because these people are total dumbasses.
Conrad, you dumb... What? Conrad...
It lays on the guilt by telling her all these people here, their families were killed for supporting your family. These are the last of their houses as well.
Yeah.
Or these are people whose families were killed. Like, it's implied that anybody that is with her, basically their whole families were slaughtered just to save her life.
Like, a thing from one of the previous scenes is that Kirio is, like, kind of feels like he's having doubts about this whole direction that they're going in. Like, it kind of feels like Kirio's just like, Are we just ruining a nice young girl's life for, like, probably pretty weak gains? We then cut to Romeo, and he naively says Juliet's name because he's completely unprepared for what's about to happen. And for once in his life, that is fair. Other times he has been dead. So this time it's just fair that he doesn't know that the pretty girl that he talked to is actually the heir to the family that his father had brutally murdered. We get the episode preview. The exultation, late to paint her cheek, will make her dance for all too short a term. She can't escape the ills of cliff and creek, and all for naught, the world it doth return. And we see clips from the next show where Juliet as the crimson whirlwind and Romeo are dueling. So we've covered the first two episodes. We'll come back to this next week. But what are people's thoughts about overall thoughts about these episodes so far?
This is a very good anime.
I was actually really surprised with the first off the quality of the anime. I wasn't expecting a whole lot. Romeo and Juliet is not my favorite work, and it's not even my favorite work by Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So, like, I was a little hesitant at first, but they've taken that, and it is very transformative.
Yeah, like, this is, in a couple of ways, this is barely Romeo and Juliet. It's more of, like, a general Shakespearean pastiche with, like, Romeo and Juliet elements. And, like, even a lot of the characters who share the names of their original selves are not, like, particularly similar to their original selves. Like, from what little we saw of, what's his face, Mercutio, and this is going to continue in later episodes, Mercutio in the play is like this like very passionate poetic guy who's like Romeo's like best friend and like is like super loyal to him. Where in this one, he's kind of just like this huge, smug, condescending dick.
That was kind of wild.
Yeah.
In the play, Mercutio's death was definitely like the best thing about the play, for me at least.
I predict his death in this is going to be totally the best thing ever in a completely different way. It's going to be satisfying when he dies.
Watch as this anime finds a way to make us love Mercutio.
Is there a way to love him?
Probably. Tragic backstory and tell us he's troubled.
I'm going to just say that Mercutio is one of my favorite characters from this anime.
Good to know. It's interesting because we haven't seen, there's a lot of like characters we haven't seen yet. Because the episodes were focused more on Juliet's point of view, where the play is a little more focused on Romeo's.
Yeah, I mean, in the play of the two, in the play they're both naive, and in this one they're still both kind of naive, but like,
in different ways.
Yeah, in different ways. But like in the play, the one who's the more kind of savvy one is Romeo. And in this one, I think that that's kind of reversed.
I wouldn't say kind of.
Yeah.
Juliet is absolutely the more savvy one, without a doubt.
Juliet is a incredibly cool main character. I like her a whole lot.
Juliet's a fucking superhero. Deal with it.
Yeah.
She's basically a musketeer Zorro, and I am loving it.
Yeah, it's great. Lord Montague is, I think, a very well-written villain. I think that some of the other villains on this show have problems, but I think that he's very compelling.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is Lord Montague daddy?
He's not hot enough.
No.
No. He does not deserve to be daddy.
He's...
I actually think he's sort of hot.
Okay, he's but he's also basically Ivan the Terrible as a Fire Emblem character.
You say that like that removed from his daddiness
hold
somehow.
Hold on, what were you saying, Elizabeth?
He's hot for a Fire Emblem villain, because usually Fire Emblem villains are drawn as either straight up monsters or like the ugliest person you would never see except for in an anime.
Yeah, there's like a couple, at least for the main villains, usually like there'll be a couple minions who are like relatively good looking. But the main
one in Fire Emblem you can romance as DLC.
Yeah, but there's usually like even like a couple ones who you can't do that with who are just like reasonably good looking villains, but they aren't the main ones. Most of the ones who are dudes that I remember are kind of spoilers, but Patrine from Path of Radiance is one that comes to mind. Ashnard, I honestly think that Ashnard is better looking than Papa Montague, if I'm going to be honest.
Three Houses especially has a higher proportion of sexy villains.
Three Houses makes who is the hero and who is the villain questionable, though, is the thing.
Yeah.
You can absolutely just be on the side of people who would normally be villains in Fire Emblem games. So I don't know if that really counts. But we're talking about Fire Emblem when we should be talking about the show. I don't think that he's daddy. I think he has like a nice voice. But other than that, I don't think that he's particularly attractive.
I wasn't expecting to like it as much as I did, and I really love it. The slight fantasy elements, the world building so far. It does have that timeless feel that a lot of Shakespeare plays has as well. The pastiche works really well.
Yeah.
I can't get over Lord Montague being Ivan the Terrible.
Yeah.
It's uncanny. Like, they even did the coat thing. It's not the same color coat, but he's still got the, like, fur-lined coat and the hat. And the beard and the stupid little mustache.
I mean, the thing that he is Venetian, Ivan the Terrible.
Yes. He's even got some of the face wrinkles.
Yeah.
I won't be surprised if they used him as a reference while drawing him.
I'd be surprised if they didn't.
Yeah. Is that the majority of our thoughts, or do people have other things they want to say?
The character animation in this is very good, but we have to talk about one thing, and the fact that, you know, even beyond the flags, holy shit, is the CGI terrible. Like, it sticks out like a sore thumb.
It is not well integrated, yeah.
When was this animated? 2011? 2008?
I think more around 2008 or 2007 or something.
You can forgive some of it for being from 2008. And also, Studio Gonzo was very hit and miss.
Yeah, I mean, it's been more hit than it usually is in this one, if we're going to be honest. 2007, it was released 2007.
So yeah, I know. So 14 years, CGI, CGI ages horribly quickly. Unless you're Pixar, you're probably going to look bad in 2007 as CGI.
But yeah, we can do predictions. Me and Coley are out of this because Coley has watched ahead and because I have seen the entire series at least once, even if I've forgotten a lot of it.
I am ahead, but only by 2 episodes.
Yeah, that is too far ahead to do predictions.
I'm going to predict on William's play and writing career. I suspect his play is going to be targeted by Montague for being too subversive or critical at some point. I think Romeo is going to definitely do something to make his father so annoyed that he basically banishes Romeo halfway through the series. And I predict Juliet is going to somehow end up being the star of one of William's plays against her will. And that causes drama.
I predict when the inevitable sword duel between the Red Whirlwind and Romeo comes up, that Juliet's just going to kick Romeo's ass. It's not even going to be like, it's going to be a very decisive victory for Juliet.
I have one prediction that's not connected to the next two episodes, and that is we're going to learn that Lord Montague probably has a tragic backstory of some sort. That unearned moral ambiguity, baby!
I don't think that's going to happen quite the way it normally happens. If the tragic backstory comes up, it's going to probably be directly related to something he brought on himself.
Yes, the consequences of his own actions.
Mm-hmm. because like the writing in this is actually really good, ignoring the interesting dialogue. Although the interesting dialogue is also good, but you know, we've already discussed that.
Yeah, I mean, like the biggest thing that's a plot hole is the whole like, why the hell would you do this whole keeping her entire backstory from her? It that part, I think there's never going to be a particularly good answer for.
I other think than the actual answer is probably that with the way they characterized Juliet.
Yeah.
If she had known, there was no way she was going to go into that party.
Yeah, they needed her to go to the party. They needed her to be able to have a crush on Romeo and for that relationship to be at least slightly developed before she realizes he's the son of the person who killed her entire family. Anyways, until next time, this may be a love that can never be, but our love for this anime is not. I'm Zeb Berrybid. This has been Anime's Journey to the West. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at Anime's Journey TW, as well as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This may be a love that can never be, but our love for this anime is not.